Welcome to the afternoon session of the January 2014 session of the Court of Appeals. We are down to three cases today by virtue of some cases being submitted without oral argument and continued, so it will be a relatively short afternoon for you all. We'll start the first case. Well, before we do that, let me introduce my panel. To my right is Judge John Irwin from Sarpy County. To my left is our newest judge, Rico Bishop from Lincoln, and I am Frankie Moore from North Platte. We'll start the day with the case of In Re Interest of Letitia S. As you're approaching, just a reminder, we are live video streaming and we also audio record. So if there are sensitive matters or names that you don't want to be spoken publicly, then just consider that. And we'll also call the case again then when you approach. So this is In Re Interest of Letitia S.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My name is Jane McNeil and I represent the mother in this case, Stacy Sleeping Bear. I'm speaking today on behalf of the father as well. We have decided to basically, I would speak for both parents today by agreement of Ms. Melgares that represented the father. This is an appeal from an adjudication in what's commonly called an educational neglect case. It occurred last April. This is the sum and substance of the argument is that the state failed to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that these parents neglected their child. By way of background, this is regarding one child. She was 8 years old at the time. What happened was we had one witness that came to court. She was what's called a student personnel assistant at the school. She monitors records and things like that. And the biggest argument that we have and our problem with this case is that this particular witness did not have the foundational expertise or knowledge about these days of school missed. There was no evidence offered but for the child's birth certificate. The problem was is this witness could not tell the court how attendance records for children are recorded, how they are kept. She stated many times that she monitors the attendance. The bottom line of that is we don't know how attendance is gathered, and that wasn't presented in court. And so it is the opinion of the appellants that the court should have disregarded that testimony as not credible. The second half of the argument.
Did the appellants deny that the absences occurred?
We did not present evidence, and what it came down to was this family had endured a fire, and there was testimony from the witness, who was the student personnel assistant, that 12 of the days of absences had happened between January and February. The petition underlying says she's missed 22 days. So there's a fire that happened in the family home. We don't know. This particular witness didn't know when it occurred. She had been notified of the fire from another unnamed employee. The witness couldn't tell. One of the things that the school is required to do is the second half of our argument is that they're offered that they're under statute, they have to offer reasonable efforts to help children attend school.
Under which statute are you referring to?
79209.
And why is that relevant to the adjudication under the juvenile code?
It's relevant because that is the statute that actually sets out when a child is whose name is to be forwarded to the county attorney. It actually sets out if a child misses more than 5 days per quarter, it's the guideline. It actually sets out, the juvenile code sets out responsibilities for the parent. This sets out responsibilities for the school district. in order to turn a child's name in who has excessive absenteeism, they have to follow state law.
Aren't the compulsory education statutes designed to impact the parents, whereas the juvenile code is there to protect the best interests of a child? And in this case, the child was missing a lot of school.
I agree with you to the extent that compulsory education is to help basically to address parents, but it's also to address the school district. Specifically, it says that the school district has to offer reasonable efforts. It sets out educational testing. It sets out meetings with parents. It sets out psychological. It sets out evaluations.
But isn't that to prosecute under the compulsory attendance statute, to prosecute the parents? Those requirements are necessary.
Yes, absolutely. And the point is, in this case, none of that was done.
But we're not in a prosecution mode here. We're in the juvenile court. I think is the question being asked is, does that matter when we're looking at educational neglect under the juvenile code? And didn't that predate the compulsory education laws?
It did predate it. I think you can't look at them separately. I think that they have to overlap because it sets out the ground, basically the framework for when a child is turned in for educational neglect.
What is your authority for requiring an in pari materia analysis, that we have to look at both statutory provisions together?
I don't know that there is authority that has addressed that question. I think that there is a common sense overlap. I think that there is a, I think you have to look at that. Otherwise, the county attorney could file a case saying 5 days is excessive, 10 days is excessive. But that sets the framework for when it has to be turned into the county attorney's office. So I think it is a necessary framework for the, to be married to the juvenile code.
Well, if we're looking at the best interest of the child, and the evidence and the record indicates that it wasn't the parents that notified the school regarding the fire, that the school actually arranged for transportation for the child to get to school in light of the difficulties alleged by the parents, and in fact that arrangement was made through a grandmother and not the parents, and that even after the school made those arrangements, the child was not attending school.
I think that that's one of the problems that we have also, in terms of there's nothing in the record to say that anyone from the school should have ever been talking to the grandmother. She's not the legal guardian. And part of the problem is the record does not have evidence of who from the school talked to the grandmother, but for this student personnel assistant. We just don't know who did what. I mean, that's what the court, I was astounded when the court found the allegations true, because in the end, the court said, this court needs to know who does what, who did what in this case. You can't just keep saying, I monitor the records, without saying, who collects the records? How's attendance actually, how is that actually prepared, those attendance records? That was never brought up. So basically, there was no evidence that was credible to the court.
Were foundational objections made? Can you refresh my memory?
They were over and over, and the foundational and the court even instructed the state that they would have to lay foundation. At some point, the court felt like the foundational requirements were met. It's not clear in the record when that was. In the closing, in the court, when they issued their order, in my mind, actually said that they didn't meet their burden of proof. It wasn't there.
Counsel, can I interrupt for a minute?
Sure.
I'm looking at your brief. There are no assigned errors in the brief. So help me here. I'm looking at the two arguments and moving to the second argument that has to do with that's why it's helpful to have assigned errors. says a separate juvenile court erred in adjudicating the mother at fault in neglecting her child's education because the school district failed to assist the family in addressing the missed days of school. I assume that's what you want to serve as your assigned heir.
Yes.
Okay. There's two statutes that we're talking about, right?
Exactly.
One's a criminal statute. The compulsory attendance or the attendance one?
Okay.
You don't think it's criminal?
No, I don't. I don't think it's criminal.
Okay.
I don't think it assigns any penalties. I don't think it assigns...
Okay.
Yeah.
We have a neglect statute under the juvenile code.
Yes.
Does the other statute exist under the juvenile code?
Does it exist?
Where is it codified? Is it in the juvenile code or is it not in the juvenile
code? It is not in the juvenile code.
Is it in the criminal code?
No, it is not.
Okay, does it have a criminal penalty?
No, it does not.
The class 3 misdemeanor.
Oh, is it? Okay, I apologize.
So, just for the sake of discussion, then let's go ahead and assume it's a criminal statute in the sense it has a criminal penalty.
Okay.
Okay, and you're not confessing anything by doing that. I'm not trying to be tricky. So, you talk about the overlap, I think was your...
Yes.
...your phrase. Do you... I'm just trying to understand your position. So, we have this, we'll just call it the non-juvenile code statute.
Okay.
That talks about attendance, right?
Yes.
And then we have our neglect, just the kind of garden variety neglect.
Yes.
It seems like what you're trying to do, and I'm not saying you're right or wrong, it seems like what you're saying is, one is, that is the neglect statute kind of is overlaid on top of that. That is, you have to prove this non-attendance, and then that'll rise to satisfy the burden of proof going neglect in the juvenile context. Is that kind of your argument?
It is. It also, the actual petition lays out the number of days and things like that, so that's...
So it's kind of a sequential argument. That is, you have to prove that that Class 3 misdemeanor statute was violated to then get to the next step of finding the parents neglected the child. Is that where you're at?
Yes.
Okay, and to your knowledge, there's no authority where this has come up before in the case law?
No, I'm not. I don't think it's been addressed.
Okay, thank you very much.
That's why we're here.
And I realize we've taken you over, but one quick question, I think
sure.
It'll be a simple answer. So the petition you mentioned alleged the number of days missed.
That's correct.
The juvenile petition. Did it cite to the compulsory education statute when it, indicated the number of days missed?
It did not.
Okay.
It was
That's
only
fine.
Under.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Ms. McNeil. We've taken you over time. How much time did we take her over?
1 minute.
Would you please add that to the appellee's time? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Sarah Graham, and I represent the interests of the state in this matter. I'm here today to request that the Court of Appeals affirm the Juvenile Court of Douglas County's finding that Letitia Siemens comes within the meaning of Nebraska Revised Statute 247-3A. Your Honors, this case is about parent inaction. It's about parents who failed to make contact with the school and failed to cooperate with the efforts by the school to work with them in order to get their daughter to school. In the time I have before you, I will address the issue of whether Michael Siemens and Stacey Sleeping Bear educationally neglected their daughter, Letitia, and why this court should affirm the juvenile court's finding. Your Honors, I would like to jump right to what you were talking about with the appellant regarding comparing and contrasting Nebraska Revised Statute 247-3A with Chapter 79, which deals with Nebraska compulsory attendance laws. There is case law, In Re Interest of Rice, which was decided by the Nebraska Court of Appeals in 1979, which states that Chapter 79, which relates to the compulsory school attendance rules, and the statutes referring to the neglect of children do not generally pertain to the same subject matter and should not be construed in pari materia. Thus, we must not confuse what is required in this case. Under 247-3A, there is no requirement that the school has to go through a checklist of specific services to offer a family. It doesn't even require that there's a magic number of 20 days that a child must miss before the state can file a petition or and that the court can subsequently find a child to be within the meaning of that statute. The juvenile court properly found that Letitia Siemens was within the meaning of Nebraska Revised Statute 43-247-3A because the facts on the whole show that Michael Siemens and Stacey Sleeping Bear did not actively assist in Letitia's education, and they failed to respond to efforts on the school's part. This was demonstrated by five things which I'd like to briefly discuss: the number of days missed throughout the year, the parents' lack of communication made to the school, the failure to respond to other efforts by the school, by the parents, the weight to be given to the fire that Ms. McNeil spoke about, and the impact on education. First, let's consider the number...
Counsel, just before you start, if I could put you on pause for a second. I'm looking at the operative pleadings here, and in count two, it cites the statute you just cited, correct, in chapter 43, and then it has some subparagraphs, A, B, C, that talk about the number of days missed, when they were missed, failing to actively get the child to school. I don't see any allegation, and I'm reading it very quickly right now off the screen, referring to any other statute, i.e. the education statute, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so you didn't allege it that way.
That's correct. It was filed under 247-3A.
And do you think that whether that non-juvenile statute exists, there can be neglect in and of itself without having to comply with the requirements of that education attendance?
Yes, Your Honor, I do think that's possible.
And is that your theory going forward here today?
Well, yes, Your Honor, and I believe that in this case, the school, even though not required to meet that checklist of reasonable efforts, did in this case provide efforts to the family, which the family did not respond to.
And that just goes to, not just, but that goes to whether or not it was neglect.
Yes.
Assistance required or not was given and they didn't take advantage of it. That
Correct.
Doesn't bode well, you're saying.
Are you saying that reasonable efforts need to be shown just under the juvenile code at an adjudication phase?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the statute, the 247-3A statute, requires it. It is evidence that can be persuaded or can be used to help persuade the court that there was indeed neglect, that efforts were provided and the parents failed to respond to those. Your Honor, if I may continue.
I'm sorry, I have another question.
Okay.
So when did the argument presented by appellant first arise? At the trial court, was it argued?
Which specific argument?
Was it argued by appellant that reasonable efforts were not made or were not proven to have been made, I assume, presented to the trial judge?
Yes.
And the trial judge responded that, slow down, the trial judge responded how to that argument?
She found that the efforts had been provided.
And that's a factual conclusion?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
And maybe to follow up on that, one more question. The reasonable efforts finding, was that in relation to the compulsory education statute, or is that in relation to the juvenile code where reasonable efforts have to be made before a child, which as I understand happened in this case, is removed from the home?
The latter, Your Honor.
And that's the finding that the trial court made in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So first, let's consider the number of days and their occurrence throughout the year. The witness testified that by February, Letitia had missed 22 days. That's the sum of both partial and full days. That means by the month of February, which is about 6 months into school, Letitia had missed about a whole month's worth of school by that time. That's a lot of instructional time to be missed and a lot of days where parents failed to fulfill their responsibility to get Letitia to school. Second, let's consider the lack of communication to the school and the school's struggle to get in contact with the parents. Per school protocol, when Letitia missed school, the school did attempt to call home to speak with parents and sent letters home regarding Letitia's attendance. However, there were times when the phone numbers the parents gave to the school were disconnected. The witness, Ann McFarland, testified that she herself attempted to make phone calls, but the numbers were disconnected, so she was not ever able to speak personally with them. There was no testimony about parents initiating contact with the school regarding the reasons for absences, and in this case, seems the only person who was concerned with communicating about Letitia's attendance was the grandmother in this case, her non-guardian grandmother. Third, let's consider other attempted contact made by the school. Although, again, the school, I would argue, does not have to meet those specific checklists of items under Chapter 79, the school did make efforts in this case to work with the family. In addition to the phone calls attempted, the school generated attendance letters, which were sent to the parental home to notify them about Letitia's attendance. Further, the school social worker did attempt to go out and meet the family at the home. However, the family was not home. And although Ann McFarland testified that typically she would send out a letter after a student had missed 12 days, she did not do that in this case because she was aware that the most immediate need was transportation due to the family's displacement due to the fire. Fourth, let's consider what weight should be given to the absences stemming from the house fire. A house fire, though tragic, should not be given more credit than it's due. The student personnel, Assistant Ann McFarland, took steps with great haste to set up transportation after the family's displacement. Letitia missed all or part of approximately 5 days of school between the time the school learned of the displacement and the time when transportation was set up. Yet even when this transportation was set up, the parents failed to even utilize that transportation. Further, it seems that the information about the fire was reported by the grandmother again, and neither Michael Siemens nor Stacy Sleeping Bear took the initiative to call the school and report that they needed attendance set up.
Ms. Graham, can I cause you to pause again? Back to the reasonable efforts. You're reciting all of the things that the school attempted to do. And we've talked about whether it's reasonable efforts under the compulsory education statute or under the juvenile code. Who has to make the reasonable efforts under the juvenile code to prevent removal of the child from the home?
That would be the state.
And what evidence is there as to what the state or the department did to prevent removal here?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the judge said that she made a risk assessment based on the information. That the state had provided regarding the efforts made by the school.
What evidence of that is there in the record?
Well, the state presented the evidence that the school had taken with the family.
So it was the school's efforts that the department relied upon in showing its reasonable efforts?
At this point, the department was not involved. In this case, Letitia was not actually removed from the home physically. She was made a state ward but allowed to stay in her home. So at this point, she had not been, we're not talking about reasonable efforts to keep her physically in the home, but to keep her, from being a ward of the state.
So the adjudication order did not have a removal from the home?
That's correct.
Okay. I misunderstood. I apologize.
Additionally, after the transportation had been set up, Letitia continued to miss more days of school. She had also missed more than 20 days in the year prior, which was not alleged in the state's petition, but just goes to show.
Ms. Graham, I know your time is short. Can we just flip to the other, I don't want to say assigned error because it wasn't assigned, but can you address the argument concerning the foundation?
Yes, sir, and I would just note for a moment that because of the fact that the mother, in this case, in her brief, made no assignments of error, that this court would, pursuant to this court's finding...
Oh, trust me, I know all that.
Okay.
Trust me.
Your Honor, in this case, the witness did state that the attendance is recorded daily by direct staff who see the children. This is input into their system. Other contacts are input into the system by secretary. If the secretary makes a phone call, it's input into that system shortly or around the time that it happens, as well as other notes input by staff that are recorded at the time and that the witness then read and relied on. This witness testified that she is a keeper of the record. She monitors the attendance information, and she gets an automatic generation notification when the student has missed 5, 12, and 20 days so that she's aware where the...
So in conclusion, I know we're running short. Number one, rules of evidence do apply to adjudications, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And is it your position that the business records case law applies here and that proper sufficient foundation was laid as far as the record keeper coming and testifying about the records?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thanks.
Finally, The absences did have a toll on her education. Ann McFarland testified that she had missed a lot of instructional time, and so there was an impairment to Letitia's education. In conclusion, I would ask this court respectfully to affirm the juvenile court's finding that Letitia Siemens comes within the meaning of Nebraska Revised Statute 43-247-3A.
Thank you very much. Ms. Graham and Ms. McNeil, you are excused, and the case is submitted. Next case this afternoon is